Just a reminder that you're listening to Background Briefing. I'm Maria Armudian. I'm host of the Scholar Circle, but I'm sitting in for Ian Masters, who is taking a well-deserved vacation. President Obama is putting pressure on Congress to reach a deal on debt, both from inside and outside of Washington. Both the president and Congress are working to avoid what they call the fiscal cliff. But some economic scholars say this so-called fiscal cliff is not what we should be most worried about. We have with us James Galbraith and George Zornick. James Galbraith is a professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of numerous books, including The Predator State, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and Inequality and Instability, A Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis. George Zornick, who also joins us, is the nation's Washington reporter and was a senior reporter at thinkprogress.org. So welcome to you both. George Zornick, I would like to start with you to give us an update about the latest with the negotiations on this fiscal cliff.
Sure. I would say there were two significant developments inside Washington today. Actually, one development happened outside of Washington and one inside it. What happened outside of Washington in Pennsylvania is that President Obama traveled to southeastern Pennsylvania and met with some middle-class people who would benefit from having that the Bush rates below the $250,000 bracket extended, and he held a press conference. And this is part of his tour to kind of take his case in campaign mode to the American people to try to apply public pressure to Republicans and moderate Democrats and Republicans to go along with his fiscal cliff plans. So that's something I think we can expect to see a lot more of going forward. And the other significant development I think that happened in Washington last night was that Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma, a very conservative member, stepped up and said, listen, the Republicans should just accept a bill now that extends the Bush tax rates on the bottom 98% of earners and fight about the top 2% later on down the road, January, February. And this is something that basically the White House has been urging Republicans to do and for Cole to step up and say that, and in fact, when he said it, he said that there were numerous unnamed Republican colleagues of his who agreed that could possibly suggest some weakening on the Republican side towards those rates. So those, I would say, are the two main developments that have happened today over this issue.
So increasingly, Republicans are abandoning this pledge that they gave to Norquist.
Well, I don't want to say that necessarily based on one guy, but I think the things that we've seen over the past few days from a small handful of Republican leaders might indicate that they're at least kind of softening. Although, really, Cole's position would not violate Norquist's pledge. He's just saying, let's extend the tax rates on the bottom 98% of earners. He's not saying, let's raise them on the top 2%. He's just saying, let's decouple this argument so that we can get more leverage, essentially, because the White House is holding this over them as leverage, that the extension of the middle class tax cuts. And I think he's actually right there. They would probably improve their position strategically were they to do that.
Before we get into the analysis of what this so-called fiscal cliff means, I wanted to get a sense of what are the parameters of each of the arguments and where the standoff is. I know that the tax rates on the $250,000 and up earners is one of the areas. So is health care. What are the other issues that they're fighting about now?
Well, there are several. One I think is the level of changes to health care programs. I mean, both say that they want to change them, but Democrats, for the most part, and much to my surprise, are kind of holding the line on not cutting benefits to people who use Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. They're willing to cut the programs and cut the expenditure some, but they, for the most part, are saying we don't want this to affect beneficiaries. So whether that will happen and the extent to which it will is certainly one sticking point. Another area is on the spending side, and this isn't a very sexy issue and as compared to the tax cuts and the entitlement programs, if one can consider that sexy. But, there is this defense sequester, which is going to happen. Republicans desperately don't want to see that level of money taken from the defense budget. And besides from that, there are a certain level of domestic side cuts that no one is really paying attention to that would probably be fairly devastating to a lot of the domestic and social spending that the government does. And that's certainly going to be a point of contention as well. Beyond all that, you have a payroll tax cut, which is expiring. You have unemployment insurance, which is expiring. You have an alternative minimum tax, which is expiring. You have a doc fix to Medicare, which is expiring. So there are all these other issues that the parties are going to be trading and horse trading over. And then on top of all of that, you have Republicans starting to make a little bit of noise about the debt ceiling, which, as far as we know, will probably be hit in December or January, though the Treasury could play with a deadline. But that's something that Republicans are starting to kind of threaten to take hostage once again if they don't get their way in these ongoing negotiations.
James Galbraith, let's bring you in now. You've been studying these issues for years. You suggest that this so-called fiscal cliff is not really so alarming, but it's being used as an alarm to change some of these programs. What are the realities?
Well, the phrase fiscal cliff is basically a public relations device to try and put political pressure on members of Congress to come up with some kind of a deal, a so-called grand bargain, in the period between now and the end of the year. And from that point of view, it's a gross exaggeration, to say the least, because not much changes within the first few days. I mean, obviously, tax rates change and so forth, but the effect on the economy of such changes is drawn out over time. If these issues were not resolved, if tax rates were allowed to go up dramatically and persisted for 6 months or a year, then you would see a real crimping on people's budgets. But if it happens for a few weeks and action is taken in the new Congress rather than the old one, effects on the underlying economy are essentially trivial. So the pressure is being certainly placed on people to come up with some kind of a bargain and to enact it in this Congress. But at the same time, I think a great many people in the Senate, particularly where the hand of the Democrats going to be strengthened by in the new Congress, are saying, well, just exactly why is it that we should be panicked into a bargain right now? On January 1st, the Bush tax cuts have expired at that point, and the decision to introduce a offsetting tax reduction for 98% of taxpayers becomes it's hard to see how that's a difficult legislative decision to take in the first weeks of January.
So the Congressional Budget Office was where the warning allegedly came from, and it had said there's a concern about dipping into another recession and unemployment going up should they miss the deadline.
No, the CBO study was over on the effect of the fiscal cliff if the policy changes that happened in the 1st of January persisted for 6 months or a year. I think actually the study covered a year's time frame, but that's not a reasonable expectation. There's no reason why the Congress can't fix everything in January rather than December.
So really what happened is that the CBO put out a study about all the various policy effects over time, and it became shoved into a short time frame.
I think that's essentially correct. And the real danger here is that in the course of trying to get past this artificial deadline at the end of the year, there may be decisions that would be very deleterious to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid over a long time horizon, over 15, 20, or 30 years. A decision, for example, to change the way in which Social Security benefits are adjusted for the cost of living could end up substantially impoverishing the very elderly in 10 or 20 years' time. That's the kind of thing that I think we have to be worried about if there were a kind of high pressure environment in which Democrats were being asked to sign up to a deal in the last days of the year.
Let's talk a moment about that, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, because the framing of it coming from the Republican leadership is really this fear of insolvency, this fear of China owning our debt and not being able to...
Yeah, this is all nonsense.
Well, this is why I wanted you to explain what the reality is.
I mean, the reality is that Social Security is a social insurance program. What it does is spread the burden of caring for the elderly and survivors and dependents and the disabled from their immediate families who may or may not be able and willing to bear that burden to the whole working population. That's the way the system works. And at the same time, it also says if you're a working person, you pay in whether you've got your own parents to support or not. That's a, as I say, a burden-sharing arrangement which has been going on for 70 years now. It's perfectly viable. There is no, it's not a money-making arrangement. It's not a business. If the government ended up paying out more for a period of time than it takes in payroll taxes, the government doesn't go bankrupt as a result of that. So there's a great deal of scaremongering, frankly, propaganda associated with Social Security, and it comes from people who don't like the program. The program has had enemies ever since it was begun. Those enemies have a lot of money to throw around. The Peterson Foundation, for example, has been doing this for a long time, and they are constantly come up with unfounded scare stories. In the cases of Medicare and Medicaid, you have, again, social insurance programs which basically apply to particular parts of the population, the elderly and the poor, people who meet a certain asset test in the case of Medicaid. If you target those programs under this very misleading rubric of the word entitlements, then what you're doing is you're saying we're going to cut back on the elderly and the poor. But the real problem in healthcare is not the elderly, the poor, it's healthcare costs in general. And the way to deal with that problem is to take measures that bend the cost curve, so to speak, that bring down the cost of providing healthcare services, not just for the people who are covered by government insurance, but also for the people who are covered by private insurance, and for that matter, for the people who go to the emergency rooms. And one of the things the president's program, the Affordable Care Act, was intended to do was to try and relieve some of that burden of cost. That's the right way to approach it, to take healthcare as a problem that has to be dealt with as a system, not as a problem of the government's budget, which it isn't.
Well, let's ask George Zornick now. Are you hearing any change in this rhetoric that Professor Galbraith is talking about right now as the debates are going on around this?
Yes. I think there's there's hundreds, literally, of fiscal cliff stories published every day in D.C. And I think if you cut through a lot of it, basically what's happening is absolutely nothing. Each side is modifying their rhetoric a bit to seem essentially more open to compromise than they probably actually are. That's certainly happening on the Republican side with talking about Norquist's pledge and the few that have said they're willing to break it. You have Democrats saying that they're open to changing entitlements, which some of them very well may be. But a lot of this is just kind of pre-posturing to make themselves appear, heading into when the actual negotiations start, to be totally reasonable and open-minded and to portray the other side as obstinate and inflexible. You have a deadline coming up in about 3 weeks on December 21st when Congress is supposed to leave Washington. And in the few days before that, if past history is any guide, is when the actual negotiations will start. So watching the rhetoric now, I think you have to take it all as kind of dime a dozen and realize that no one is actually negotiating with each other yet, but instead kind of negotiating for a public image as a reasonable party to this deal.
Yeah, I think that's right, that what you're seeing now is that great art form, the bad faith display of good faith, which the optimist in me says that it really is all in bad faith and that there will be obstinacy and no deal on December 21st. What I worry about is that somebody will try to make a political hay out of having come to a bargain at the cost of programs that are really valuable to large parts of the population.
So if we were going to look at what some of these various case scenarios could be, James Galbraith, you had laid a few of them out. You talked about what could happen with the military and what could happen with discretionary federal spending. What's your take on the potential results here?
Well, I think the one area, and I think George mentioned this in his introductory remarks, that we should worry about if there's no arrangement to defer it, are disruptive cutbacks in essential federal services in the new year. One can think about, for example, the Federal Aviation Administration. Can it maintain all the air traffic control centers on the budget that it will have? All of these agencies will, of course, be trying to maintain services on the assumption that the problem will be resolved and they'll get the money that they need in sufficient time. So things will not happen immediately. But if there's a big delay, then those sequesters could buy those services. The military, I'm not worried about. There's just a ton of money there, and the needs and demands are coming down anyway, so the military can handle its side of the sequester. There's no cause for panic there at all. And as I say, on the tax side, maintaining demand for and maintaining the incomes of the middle class is something that can be handled, in due course. It shouldn't be allowed to go too long, but if it happens in January or February, the middle class will have come through Christmas. It won't be in a position where it's going to run out of money because of shopping demands in January. So I think the real issue is that there will be some real discomfort. People who lose unemployment insurance, that's a problem that should be dealt with. Let me think. The payroll tax holiday, which is not on the table, nobody expects that to be extended, but that will bite into middle class and working class incomes, for sure. But I think that's basically something that can't be avoided at this point.
George Zornick, let's go back to you for just a bit and look at the latest developments with Timothy Geithner. What is the significance of him going to meet with leaders?
Although the White House won't fully admit it, he seems to be kind of the point person in negotiating a lot of this deal, and I think it's something that's worrying to a lot of progressives, and rightly so, because he's a guy who whose resume is not one that would suggest he's going to be overly sympathetic or understanding to some of the things, like the domestic side services, like Medicaid, like the safety net. That's just not his experience. He's a Wall Street guy. He's a big picture guy. He's someone who I think is going to be much more sensitive to bigger and mainly trumped up concerns about the deficit than he will be to, preserving discretionary non-defense spending in the U.S. So I think that's something that's giving progressives a lot of heartburn and probably rightfully so.
It could potentially be strategic, though, for Obama to send Geithner, the closest to the conservatives and the Republican Party of all of his go-to people. Would you say that could be it?
Sure, that's certainly possible, and I think there's a tendency on all sides to kind of overanalyze things when during this period when not much is in fact happening. And I think the other thing is that ultimately, I think we can assume that the prerogatives of the president will be carried out in these negotiations. So what he and his close team decide to do are basically what Geithner will push for, and his resume and his personal inclinations may not be all that huge of a factor.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about this situation, and George may have some insight onto this, is that we don't really know, after all of this time, what the gut instincts of the president really are on this matter, which way he will turn. Will he stand to defend the basic safety net and social insurance program, or will he go along with some proposal that basically in some subtle way undermines them? I don't think we really know at this point. I think that, as George said, progressives have some anxiety about this. But it really is remarkable. The president's been president for 4 years, and there are still, doubts and questions.
Although he has indicated during the campaign process that he would stand, it sounded to me, in my interpretation anyway, he'd stand pretty firm on the issues of Medicare and Medicaid and that sort of a thing. Was that your interpretation as well, James Galbraith?
I think it's hard to say. In the first debate with Governor Romney, he made some comments about Social Security, about how their positions were not very far apart, which were truly frightening. The problem here is that everybody wants to represent to the public that they're defending Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the other core social and protections that we have, but they can do that and at the same time allow, let's say, appears to be a technical adjustment to go into the law, which undermines them over 20 or 30 years. And that is the thing that really should not be allowed to happen in the next 3, 4, 5 weeks.
And I guess finally, what I'd like to just touch on is this aspect of mass media as well as the social media, because it seems like the panic has been exacerbated by the way it is being framed publicly. Would you, George Zornick, would you agree with that?
I'm not totally sure. That's one of the things I've been kind of curious about and unable to quantify is how closely people in the country are really following these negotiations or even understand exactly what's happening. I think after there's a tendency, after the campaign season ends to just on a lot of people's behalf, especially with the holidays coming up, to just kind of disconnect from this process. So that hasn't happened in D.C., and all the folks covering the campaign have, much to the regret of their companions and family, plunged right into covering this fiscal cliff stuff. But outside in the country, I'm sensing a certain sense of disengagement or disinterest in what's happening. And part of that is just because it's very difficult to understand once you dive into, a lot of the fiscal policy measures that are happening here. It's not particularly interesting.
And I think that the people are inured to this to a certain degree. They do understand that there's a big propaganda campaign going on, that this is an inside Washington lobbying operation. They are not terrorized by the idea that the country is about to go off a fiscal cliff, whatever that means. They've seen this kind of thing before, and they tend to be quite level-headed about it. There's a limit to the amount you can really propagandize the American people on a matter like this. But inside Washington, inside the Capitol, as George says, it's 24/7. The lobbies who were basically preparing this before the election unleashed it on election day. You could already see it in the Wall Street Journal. I think in the New York Times there were propaganda stories, and then it's been nonstop ever since.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us and for helping us to understand this.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
James Galbraith is a professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of numerous books, including The Predator State, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and Inequality and Instability, A Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis. And George Zornick is the nation's Washington reporter and was a senior reporter for thinkprogress.org. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.